The parable of the importunate widow, as this gospel reading is often called, seems pretty straightforward. Look, Jesus says, if even a cold-hearted judge who does not give a hoot about what God or anybody else thinks will eventually hear out a pesky widow's complaint and grant her justice, how much more will God, who is and only can be goodness, respond to the cry of his people? Well, that seems fairly clear. Until it doesn't. Like, what am I supposed to do when God seems to be silent? When someone I love still suffers, and some awful thing in the world just keeps on being awful? Am I not pesky and importunate enough? The word importunate, by the way, is an adjective that means troublesomely urgent or persistent. The verb importune means to beset with insistent requests. Aside from those scary times when serious illness or danger or misfortune come upon us or someone dear to us, when is my prayer troublesomely urgent or persistent? And even if it is, do I really think God is listening? Prayer seems to be just as likely to met with silence as with a word we can see and hear from God. So maybe, really, why bother? And besides, I don't want to be a pest, and I don't want to be known as a pest. Do you? Who am I to pester God? Like all of Jesus' parables, at first we think we get it, that it makes a straightforward and clear point. And then suddenly we discover that we are in a thicket of questions that are really hard to answer. Fortunately, with this parable at least, Luke gives us a little compass to carry to help us find our way through the thicket. He says that this is a parable about the need to pray always and not to lose heart. This is a parable about prayer and not losing your heart. Years ago, I lived next door to a man whose name was Addio Mancini. Mr. Mancini was a 90-year-old widower when we first became his neighbors, and he died about 5 years later, just before his 96th birthday. At first, I was delighted to have Mr. Mancini as a neighbor. He was such a character. He was about 5'5", bandy-legged. He had these enormous hairy ears and a big voice that had never lost this accent from the streets of the Bronx where he was born and raised. Mr. Mancini also cussed when he talked. He absolutely peppered every sentence with expletives. And not just the mild ones, but the full-bodied, spicy ones, too. When I quote Mr. Mancini in this sermon, do not fear, I am not going to say any of these words. I'll leave it up to your imagination to fill in what he might have actually said. Mr. Mancini was on a sort of mission in these, his latter years. And his mission was to give you the advice he had to give about almost any subject you could think of. Mr. Mancini was not shy about telling you how you were doing something wrong and how he knew exactly the right solution to your various shortcomings, failures, ignorance, and outright stupidity. Mr. Mancini never stepped back from reminding me of how I was raking my leaves incorrectly, or how my diet was going to kill me, or how my ignorance of the stock market and how it worked was destined to doom me to penury. And honestly, it was not his penchant for pointing out how astoundingly dim-witted I was about so many things that bothered me. No, what bothered me was how long it would take for Mr. Mancini to tell me what he wanted to tell me. If he spied me cutting the grass between his house and ours, he would walk right up, yell at me to turn off the lawnmower, and then spend the next, I kid you not, hour and a half describing what was wrong with me, which is a long time. Eventually, it brought out the worst in me. And what I mean is I started hiding from Mr. Mancini. I would sneak to the window and look out to see if he was outside before I would go out back to work in the flower bed. And if he came outside while I was outside, I would figure out some way for him not to see me, or I would pretend he wasn't there. I know that's wrong. But it was driving me crazy. And besides, he gave me the same four or five stories over and over again. So little by little, I ceased to be Mr. Mancini's neighbor. I withdrew behind a stoic, distant, unavailable half smile or a perfunctory wave as I hurried away from him. Mr. Mancini may have been importunate, troublesomely besetting me with his insistent requests for my attention. But I was becoming something worse. He began to become invisible to me because I withdrew my heart from him. Till one day, I was outside and Mr. Mancini must have seen me and hurried out his screened-in porch. He hadn't lectured me properly in weeks, so he came at me with a full head of steam. Seeing him, I gave one of my little perfunctory waves and tried to make a beeline for anywhere but there. But then I heard him shout at me, "Who do you think you are, Hitler?" Stunned, I stopped in my tracks, turned around and faced Mr. Mancini and said, "What?" He said, "That wave you give me, that wave you always give me like this, it makes you look like Hitler with your little Sieg Heil." Okay. Before I knew it, Mr. Mancini had me. He hurriedly covered familiar ground, the way I cut the grass, the fact that I had not yet installed gutter guards, like he told me a million times, the fact that I was dooming my kids to the poorhouse because I wouldn't listen to his plan for investing. And then he said, "Come inside, I got to show you something." So he had me. And he had me on so many different levels. Inside in his kitchen, he opened his freezer and he showed me steaks that had just arrived special order from some special place in Oklahoma, and how if I had a lick of sense, which I didn't, I'd order my meat from the same guy he did. He told me how to invest my money, where I could get gutter guards, and how to get free straw to protect the grass seed I had just put down. It was a lot. And then he said, "Come in here." And he led me into his den. I glanced at my watch and I realized that it was already an hour with no end in sight. So I decided just to give in. Then in the den, Mr. Mancini, who was always on to the next topic, always ready for the next learning experience, lost his stride. And he just sort of wandered around in his den for a little bit. And he didn't speak. It was odd. He was always on to his next lesson with me. But here he was faltering. He stood in front of the mantle over the fireplace, and he stared at a series of framed pictures that were perched on the wooden beam. Finally, he said, "See this?" He wasn't really waiting for an answer from me. He was staring at an old framed picture, very old picture, with a middle-aged couple. He says, "That's my mom and my dad." And I stepped forward to say to him how handsome his dad was and how beautiful his mom. But before I could say a word, he said, "You know what I do every night just before I go to bed? It's how I say my prayers. Every night I start right here at their picture and I tap right here in front of it 7 times. I looked, and sure enough, right in front of that picture on the mantle was a tiny little groove, a tiny place where the wood was worn from where he had tapped persistently, importunately, night after night, year after year. "And then I go to this one," he said, "my wife, and I tap here 7 times too. And then I blow a kiss." And he did. "And then I come over to this picture right here. See, that's my boy. He died when he was 11. But here, see, with him, I don't tap 7 times. I mean, I do tap 7 times. But then I add one more. And that extra one means, I'll see you soon." Mr. Mancini, in 1,000 different ways, had been banging on my door for so long so he could finally show me the people that he had loved and that he had lost and how he hadn't lost heart. He wanted to show me how he hadn't lost heart. And I tried to make him invisible. That's why Jesus says to keep praying day and night, because only prayer can keep the world around us and the God who loves it and who is knocking at our door from going invisible. It's how we keep from losing heart. Amen.